Shayna, I have a confession this morning.
Oh, man. Do I want to hear this, Chris?
I don't know, but, you know, this is the special time when it's just you and me. And so, you know, sometimes it's a good moment for confession. And my confession is this. I figured out that there's a name for the way that I manage my anxiety and my potential despair about the world.
Oh, yay. Okay.
It has a name.
It has a name.
Yes. The name of what I do is called defensive pessimism.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's a strategy of damage control to manage anxiety and despair. And it's the attitude that things can always get worse, but they are always better than we deserve. So it's like the secret of success in life is having low expectations.
Yes. And that way you won't be disappointed.
Yeah. So I'm just trying to figure out why I sometimes take this angel of darkness perspective, but it's really a defense mechanism.
And now I know.
Welcome to What in God's Name? She is Shayna Appel.
And he's Christopher Owen.
We are recasting the stories we tell ourselves about our shared public life together using the lenses of philosophy and theology, because the usual ways of telling stories about our shared common life, the stories that are told through political and economic lenses, really diminish human flourishing and ecological flourishing, really flatten a picture of who the human being is.
And as we try to talk ourselves and walk ourselves out of some of the holes we've dug ourselves into these days, we need just a little bit more than that binary shovel.
We welcome you to our show. And if you want to hear more about What in God's Name, I invite you to go to our homepage on our website, whatingods.com. There's a little trailer there, and that prevents me from launching into a 5-minute explanation of who we are and what we do.
Thank goodness.
I know. You were itching to get beyond that.
I was.
We do have a spinny wheel, again, described in our little trailer. Basically, the Cliff Notes version is we spin it, and then we talk about it.
Go for it, Christopher. I believe it's your turn.
Narrative cultural therapy. Another phrase for what we do. Narrative therapy. Shayna, you have like a really great, precise definition of narrative therapy. Say it.
I do.
Yes, you do. Narrative therapy. To change the story, change your life. That's your phrase.
Change the story. Yes. Change the narrative. Change the world.
Ooh. So narrative therapy is a psychotherapeutic approach. You can use it in individual psychotherapy. And we, on One in God's Name, we want to tell more hopeful stories about our shared common life. Reframing, again, reframing our understanding of our shared common life, telling deeper stories. Narrative cultural therapy. Upcoming shows, we are going to have a conversation with Jeff McDonald. He is a journalist and a pastor. We are also wanting to announce and to tease and to tell you that we are going to engage in a conversation about climate change. We're bringing together two people who are leaders in climate change organizations. Lila Corman Glazer is the executive director of 350NH.org. We're bringing Lila into conversation with Tori Goebel of Young Evangelicals for Climate Action. So stay tuned for this interesting conversation that we will have soon. Let me tie up one more thing. Shayna, this is apropos of our shows that we've just recently done on the market as God. Economics, the oversized place that economics plays in our shared common life together. I got an email from the Wendland Cook Program in Religion and Justice at Vanderbilt Divinity School, and they are advertising a really interesting program. It's called Churches and Cooperatives, and it's a conversation on how clergy and faith leaders of religious institutions can join the solidarity and cooperative economy. This is exactly the kind of thing that you and I are talking about, just in terms of using theological understanding and theological reflection on human beings and human flourishing to address how the market has become the false god. And so I just thought it was interesting just to follow up on the shows that we have done the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, for sure. That's an invitation to change the narrative.
Nice. Yeah, that is so. All right, let's launch into today.
Chris, you and I had been having some conversations about where the stuff of the church gets misplaced sometimes, or, you know, what is the church today? What is the church in contemporary America look like? I was reflecting on the long arc of the church, where, you know, mainstream Protestantism in the United States really was at its peak during the 50s. We had the social gospel movement and some very prominent theologians, and people were active and they were engaged. And most people on Sundays went to church. If you were Protestant, if you were Catholic, you were in church on Sunday. And then towards the end of the 50s, that begins to fall off.
And let me just add this, the part of American Protestantism that we know as fundamentalist was quiet at that time. They had really retreated after the Scopes trial and controversy surrounding evolution and just modern science in general. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was an interesting time in American Protestantism.
Yeah, it certainly was. And I was reading this book, The Almost Church, Redefining Unitarian Universalism for a New Era by Michael Dural. And, you know, he's talking about the church living on borrowed time, and I just want to read a short section from that chapter. He writes, "Church closings stem in part from the mass exodus of people from mainline Protestant congregations that began in the late 50s. Church closings will also result from the inability of traditional churches to recognize that seismic changes have occurred in the religious landscape around them, and their failure to respond to these changes. For example, hundreds of universalist churches closed decades ago because their once radical message of universal salvation was absorbed into the larger culture. Having successfully preached their message, they faltered. The disheartening scenario of church closings is a matter of demographics as well as theology. Only about 50 to 60 UU churches, 5% of all congregations in the association, have seen measurable numerical growth over the past decade. The remaining 95% have experienced negligible growth at best, or more likely, membership plateaus and declines as congregants grow older, grayer, and fewer. The demographic trends also indicate that senior members, those in their 70s and 80s, the generation known as institution builders, will not be with us that much longer. This generation has supported churches with their volunteer labor for decades and decades, through good times and bad. Once these dedicated souls have passed on, it is unlikely that younger generations will provide a commensurate level of financial support. Many churches will close simply because they will not have the money to remain open."
Is that a bad thing?
Well, that is exactly interesting question you should ask, because I am more and more leaning towards that is not a bad thing. Again, I think you have to have some faith in resurrection. And we talked a little bit about this at the end of last week's show. You know, we talk about the phoenix rising from the ashes, but before the phoenix can rise from the ashes, itself combusts and drops into a pile of ash. And that may be what is happening to the churches now. You know, once upon a time, I was talking to two young adults about what does it mean to be the church in this time of postmodernity? And of course, what it means to be the church depends on the time that you live in, where your church is, right? Because being the church today in a place like Nigeria is very different from being the church today in a place like the United States. But that my feeling was that the call of the church in all times and in all places is to be radically countercultural. And I think one of the things that happens in the United States during the social gospel movement is that the churches really became, I mean, they defined the new common thought. The thought of the church did really make it loudly into the public square. But as people bought that message, right, as it became like, oh, yeah, okay, we got that, then that was commonplace. You didn't have to be in church that's just sort of now accepted as sort of a ground of being, if you will. And without creating a new message to come forward with or some way of hitting refresh on the old message. So now the question becomes, so now what? So now what does the church have to offer? Now, last week we were talking about how, you know, the economy has become the new God. And as we come into the holiday season, you know, we're all encouraged to make our offerings at the altars of The Gap and Toys R Us and Macy's and, right? You know, this is a time for the church to pull back from that, to do, in essence, what you and I are trying to do with this show, I think, which is to hit refresh on theological exploration of contemporary issues, to be asking more questions rather than, you know, forcing old narratives and old stories down people's throats in a way that just doesn't make any sense for them.
So much there, Shana. I am fascinated with one of the things you said. I think it's a key question, and it always is wrestled with or should be wrestled with, which is the relationship of our faith communities, of church, the institution of church, the practice of church, the relationship of that to the wider culture and being countercultural. And sometimes the relationship is too tight. The church takes on the characteristics of the culture and doesn't then have a distinctive message. The church loses its saltiness, its yeastiness. And on the other hand, and this is a stance taken by some Christians and other faith traditions too, but I'll speak of Christianity because that's what I know, this whole sense of being separate from. Rod Dreher wrote The Benedict Option, saying the culture is so hostile to Christianity that really our option is to do what Saint Benedict did in the medieval times, which is separate off, start monasteries. Saint Benedict is the founder of the
Benedictine order, yes.
Benedictine order.
And those are the monks that have the really good brewery, aren't they? down and around Gardner, Mass someplace.
Yeah. So I'm telling a story there by painting it this way, that churches can go too far towards separatism and too far towards accommodation of the culture. And that's just an observation. I think the moment we are in calls for, at least in the pieces of Christianity that I'm familiar with in America, calls for a new kind of countercultural practice and storytelling, countercultural to some of the things we talk about, economics, stupid politics, the way that it's framed and practiced. And so what does that countercultural stance look like? Well, I gave an example from the Wendland Cook program. There are other ways and different stories, like different stories of who we are.
I think one of the things that the evangelical church has in its favor is the fact that it is sort of unabashedly passionate. You know, we hear these stories and we read all these stories about, you know, all these young people today who are anti-institutionalist and define themselves as spiritual but not religious, which to me says they've been fed an old story in a way that makes no sense to them, and they're just not interested in it. If that story cannot be brought forward, cannot be made fresh and told in a way that brings its bearing to what is happening now in our lives, and done so with a sense of passion and aliveness, done so with a real deep sense of spirit, then no, they don't want to come and you know, talk about this.
Yeah, can I pick up on that? Because in preparation for this conversation today, I sketched out what I think the story, like if we think of the church and its value today in the United States, here are some sketched notes that I scribbled down. A value of our churches in this culture is to keep a vision slash hold a story. And what is the story? The world is ultimately good and worth our love and care. I think that's countercultural. And the world and humans, the world is a fallen and broken place that cries out to be redeemed by sacrificial love. And finally, the church exists to be a model of how a sacrificial and loving God intends for us to live together.
That's pretty comprehensive. I think I would say the same thing. I'd probably use
different language, but yeah.
But basically the same thing. And you and I have had this conversation before where I think of the church as a spiritual gym, you know, as a place where in the average congregation are people who, is a gathering of people who, were it not for their membership in this particular institution, their paths would probably never cross. I mean, there's just a great deal of difference in between people, even if there's not a great deal of racial, ethnic, gender identity, sexual expression, you know, all of that. If there's not a whole lot of diversity there, there's just diversity in who people are and how they live their lives and what sorts of things interest them, which often, you know, winds the church up, and then people start getting cranky with one another, and then we start looking just like the world outside of our doors, because people forget that this is the place where we reach, where we stretch to live into our covenantal relationships. So learning to be gentle with one another, learning that, you know, you can be committed to a community in which you're not going to love 100% of what happens, you know, live with it. And if something's going on that isn't, you know, rolling your socks up and down, look towards somebody else in the community who you care a great deal about. Maybe it's rolling their socks up and down. Can you just be happy for that and let go of your own need to have, you know, everything meet your approval or everything meet your... And it's one of the places where I find a lot of churches today falling down is we're not sort of really beating that drum. We look too much like the society outside our doors. I mean, we are too immersed in petty little grievances over this, that, and the other thing. And I just don't think have any place in religious community. So you got to ask yourselves, you know, why would somebody want to come in here? If the churches were living into that covenant of, you know, building the beloved community, or as we'd say in the language of Christianity, being builders of the kingdom of heaven here on earth. If we were actually doing that, my God, people would be poking each other in the butt with forks to get in our doors, for God's sakes. You know, it would be like a breath of fresh air from this caustic world in which we live.
Yeah, and you've been talking about Unitarian Universalists and the mainline Protestant denominations, but I follow what's going on in the evangelical world. I follow what's going on in the Roman Catholic world. And similar enculturation is happening in those places as well. The divisions in those branches of American Christianity map out very similarly to the political divisions, which tells me that the churches are not doing their job. We should not be mapping out the way society maps out. It's a symptom of our own inability to form ourselves and form our communities, again, using the Christian language, in Christ. We are formed in the cultural narratives that are fed to us.
We are formed in the cauldrons of economics and politics,
and
right?
Disordered loves, to use Augustine's phrase.
Yeah. Yeah, disordered loves, not love like agape, not that deep and abiding love, but more often than not, lust or desire for, we talk about presentism all the time, lust and desire for that which is right here, right now. And of course, you know, the way that consumerism is really forced upon us from all directions is one example of that we talked about last week. But I think there are any number of lessons that we could point to that are taught pretty heavily in today's public square, but really which have absolutely no place in church. The other place that I think is interesting, where I see a lot of churches succumbing, if you will, to the economic narrative, is the extent to which lay leaders will attempt to bring a business model in, to a church. And I'm not saying that the church can't benefit from anything from the business model, but ultimately, we're not a business. And yet I have seen that seep way, way, way into the culture of many of the churches that I have served. Conversely, those churches that exist with open hands where their finances are concerned, I stepped into a church a couple of years ago in West Brattleboro, Vermont, a Unitarian Universalist church that had a paltry little endowment. I mean, a paltry little endowment, yet they give away their collection plate in its entirety every Sunday. The leaders of the church they're manifesting this, church of the open hands and gifts, and how important it is for us to sustain those institutions around us that are doing great work. When it came around time to, actually resurrect the stewardship campaign, which is something that had gone by the wayside for reasons I'm not sure I fully understand, but when we resurrected that, like, we came back in the first year, increased giving by like 150%, like doubled and a half, our giving. So I served that congregation for 4 years, and we went from, less than $50,000 endowment to, I think, somewhere around $130,000, $140,000, which by today's standards is still pretty small for a church endowment and small for a church their size. But, they weren't stopping there. I'm sure they've continued to grow, because who they were was just a people of, like, they just didn't worry about that. It wasn't like, this isn't the church of our endowment. We're not pledging ourselves at that altar. We realize that the endowment plays a role in the future health of the church, but there's really no point to closing your doors, shutting off the heat, turning out the lights, and calling it a day and closing your church permanently with $1.5 million endowment in the bank, right? Because it was all about preserving the endowment to the point where it cost, it cost the church its life. And we see that all over the place.
My final thought on this today, Shana, is I'm thinking of the deeper story of how we can understand this moment. And I'm thinking of how Karl Barth said, the Bible is the continuing story of how God hates religion. And the story
that works.
The story under that is that the Spirit is bigger than what we contain. So that if the institutional church in its many forms in the United States closes up and goes away, that doesn't mean that the Spirit...
It doesn't mean God is dead.
That doesn't mean God is dead. It doesn't mean that God is not active.
Right.
In fact, our job then is to identify the places where God is active.
And I just want to say that you know, for all those folks who are anti-institutionalist, let me just say that in the same way that many of our folks throw the baby out with the bathwater, I would hate to see them do the same because, you know, churches as institutions are filled with, you know, all of those 70 and 80 year olds who have sustained us. And they are really good at organizing stuff. They know how, you know, they know how to organize stuff. So, you know, before you throw the baby out with the bathwater, it might behoove you to get to a church now and again, you know, one that you can bear and learn from these people because they're not going to be with us that much longer. And I would hate to see that institutional skill lost.
Be curious, Shana.
Go deep, Chris.
And shine light.
You have spent the last 26 minutes with Chris Owen and Shana Appel, hosts of What in God's Name?
This show is brought to you by our generous donors on Patreon. For as little as $3 a month, you can be part of the producers and the supporters of What in God's Name. For more continuing conversations, check out the series that Shana and I did on democracy, shows 400 to 407. Indeed, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever and wherever you get your podcasts, and of course, subscribe. Today's show is also brought to you by the new Dodge Theocrat, extended cab, one-ton pickup truck, part of their new G-Series pickups with eye-popping maximum towing capacity. Get on down to your local Dodge dealer and test drive a Theocrat today, Shana. When you want to be lord of the open road, the Theocrat is your only choice. The new Dodge Theocrat, official vehicle of the Ayatollahs.
That's nuts. Are we going to get into trouble? The official, is the last sentence on that going to get us into trouble?
No. Great to be with you today, Shana.
Always good to be with you, Chris.